Tensions in Jacksonville ease up and there's no more curfew today, but other forms of protest continue here in Florida and across the country. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, local officials say they've heard the protesters, so what would change look like in this city? It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll go outside and take in the beauty of our First Coast in today's wild Florida. That's later on. But first this hour, the COVID crisis does continue. The latest numbers are statewide. We have 56,830 cases, 2,460 deaths. In our area, we have 2,555 cases of COVID and 95 deaths, including one new one overnight in Duval County, a 75-year-old woman. Well, in other news, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry did not call for a curfew again last night. This after 2 days of sometimes violent clashes between protesters and police. Things are quiet this morning, but most officials have acknowledged change is needed after this weekend's protests over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Long-standing disparities in this city and frustration with police are nothing new. They've been driving a lot of the unrest we saw here. But what would change in Northeast Florida actually look like? This morning, we're pleased to welcome Jacksonville City Councilmember Brenda Priestley-Jackson. She's on the line. Councilwoman Priestley-Jackson, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, and thanks for being with us. Also joining the show, Dr. Tammy Hodo of UNF. She lectures on diversity, inequality, and mass incarceration. Hi, Dr. Hodo.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And we'd like your reaction to everything that's going on around the region, the state, and the country. Give us a call. This is also a worldwide story. There are solidarity protests happening in countries around the world right now. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Brenda Priestley-Jackson, let's begin with you. The city council met virtually on Zoom after the protests we saw over the weekend in this city. And council members like yourself said that you've heard the protesters and you understand where they're coming from. And so how do you see the city council's role in engaging with people in this city who continue to complain about police-involved shootings, and in particular, JSO not releasing body cam video that documents some controversial encounters?
First off, I think that what you saw on Saturday was just the culmination of decades of frustration. And so in terms of city council engagement, from my perspective, it does not radically alter my agenda. So when I was elected and the platform that I ran on, which is economic opportunity, education, and quality of life, we already had several police-involved and state-sanctioned murders of black lives around the country. I mean, as a mother of two African-American sons and two African-American daughters, that's a ritual in our house to tell our young people as they come of age how to engage in a healthy, safe way with the police. And so I think it now calls for specific targets and an ability to address what we see are the inequities and lack of opportunity that does not extend all around Jacksonville. And so I anticipate we will have programs and platforms in place to make certain that educational opportunities, i.e. jobs, i.e. work, extend to all sectors, and more accountability. And so we are now looking into what is the current status of the body cams? You know, what are the policies relative to the body cams with JSO? Why have the videos not been released? Are there, in fact, videos that have been taken at this point in time? Because I think the community needs that level of accountability and that level of assurance that we're not going to have the same degree of egregious abuses we've seen around the country.
What's your reaction to the institution of a curfew? Jacksonville was not unique. We saw that in cities across America.
I was surprised and shocked, actually, because I did not know we were going to have it. And the only reason I became aware of it, I was actually leaving the Urban League where we'd had the Zoom press conference meeting regarding the unrest that occurred the night before, and we were going to Brooklyn to pick up dinner to go. And that's when I saw other protesters in Jacksonville and a very, very strong presence of JSO blocking streets and things. And I felt the notice was late, and I think that that created a disadvantage. I think that it's a thin line between authoritarianism at this time and protecting the public. And I don't know that, I'm not second-guessing the mayor's decision to do that. I'm second-guessing the timeliness of sharing that decision with the public.
All right. It's 549-2937 to join us. Dr. Tammy Hodo, UNF, also with us. Last night, we watched as peaceful protesters across from the White House were dispersed before the onset of a curfew with tear gas and flashbangs. So that the president could participate in a photo op at a church near the White House. This morning, Jacksonville is quiet, but there are more protests planned in the area, including one tonight in Nocatee. Hanging over the Arlington Expressway, somebody hung a sign this morning. It's been tweeted out, and I'm looking at it now. They tweeted, they hung a sign that said, Black Lives Matter, no martial law. And so in this country now, we see a division between those in solidarity with the protesters and concerned about authoritarianism, and at the same time, frustration over some of the violent protests around the country and the looting and destruction of property. And so there's a lot to get into here. I'd like to begin by asking you your thoughts about last night in front of the White House.
Well, I definitely think that was a photo op. I don't think the president was very compelling in regards to people being peaceful. It was more of an authoritarian type conversation versus understanding and listening to the populace that are saying that they're sick and tired of being sick and tired. I, like the council member, think that there are a lot of things that need to be addressed. We continue to see, economic injustice. We see mass incarceration. We see hyper-segregation. We see, low-income schools that are predominantly filled with students of color that do not have all the resources that other schools have. And so I think that people, it's a flashpoint. People have just gotten to the point where they're not able to sustain or take it anymore. I think emotionally we're exhausted. And we've seen issues like with the Amy Cooper issue in Central Park. She knew exactly what to do in regards to calling the police, what to say, and what could have potentially happened to that African-American man is exactly what happened to George Floyd. We've seen the case with Ahmaud Arbery, and how we were not aware of the incident until May, and it happened in February. And the only reason I believe that they were arrested is because of the public outcry. The mere fact that it happened in February and no one even knew about it until May is problematic. And then people wonder why communities of color are so distrustful of police. And this just adds into that.
Okay. And then going beyond that, some comments on our Facebook page in particular that I want to ask you about. Here's one. A protest is one thing, a riot is another. You need to discuss the folks who are destroying both public and private property. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that
a bit. Brenda Priestley Jackson, you and then Dr. Hodo.
Yes. Okay. I find it very interesting when folks want to have that dichotomy or draw those distinctions. And so you have to be very careful that you're not valuing certain property over certain lives, because that's clearly what you can interpret that to be. And I think we must not disassociate the history of rioting in this country from the oppression of the African-American community. You know, there was a riot in Rosewood, Florida, that killed an entire community of black folks. There were riots after we had the ratification of the 13th and the 14th Amendment to have deconstruction that led to Jim Crow in this country. And so if you don't value my life, if you're not hearing me share with you that I need an equal opportunity, I need to I need to not be targeted. It. I need to not be profiled. I don't need a community that is hyper-policed. And you've clearly displayed in our capitalist society that you value property more than people, then I'm going to hit you where it hurts. But I want to be real clear. That didn't start with protests now. That's the history that's a carryover from slavery, Jim Crow, and different times in this country when there has been African-American advancement. That was the response that was met. And so, you know, to sit now and say that these are the bad actors are those who use the arm of the law to take black lives. The bad actors are the vigilantes in our communities that go after black lives and have made black folks feel like the other 400 years later. And so that's a really dangerous message. You know, I'm worried about the property. I'm going to lock you down, but I'm not worried about the people.
Dr. Hodo.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree with the council member that with the councilwoman, this is not new. I mean, yesterday, I think, was the anniversary of Tulsa, Oklahoma, when white protesters went and destroyed a whole community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that was economically advantageous for the African-American community and was kind of an enclave. I think that what we're seeing are a few antagonistic people, basically a few rogue people who are the ones who are doing the destructive, incidents in regards to the property. But again, at what point do our lives matter? You know, I think that people are very confused about the agenda of Black Lives Matter. I think that it's not necessarily Black Lives Matter. Individuals who are setting fires, who are breaking windows. We've seen pictures of Caucasian people who have been doing that. And I just question, you know, are they there, some of those for antagonistic reasons to kind of diminish what these protests are about. And again, King said the protests are basically the voices of the unheard. And for 400 years, African Americans have definitely felt unheard.
All right, let's go to some calls now. Lots of calls this morning, and then we'll get to your tweets and emails in a moment. Keith in Riverside, go ahead, Keith.
Yes, good morning, Melissa. The body cam issue is very important. Sheriff John Rutherford apologized to me on air on your show about the conduct of two of his officers after I explained to him how they had mistreated me, gave me a ticket for running a red light. The only thing that saved me was I always keep a disposable camera in my car so that I can document whatever's happening if I find myself in a situation. The judge threw out the charges when I went to court. I told the sheriff that his officers were misbehaving. When I went to Internal Affairs, they laughed at me and then got angry with me, said they weren't going to investigate that. These body cameras will help people, citizens, protect themselves and prove their cases. The reason they won't release it is because they don't want the public to see what's on it.
Keith, I'm sorry that happened to you, and I appreciate the call. Brenda Priestley Jackson, the body cameras came to Jacksonville and to JSO after years of activism and lobbying to get them. Then that happened. We saw that happen in cities around the country. The whole idea behind the body cam footage is that it can protect both the public and the police officer to back up their account of an interaction, too. And so we have not been able in the local media to see any body cam footage yet of some incidents that protesters referenced when they were out this weekend, including the death of one student, a FAMU student, who was shot and killed here in Jacksonville after an encounter with a police officer. The footage is not available when it comes to several incidents. This is public record. It is paid for by the taxpayers. That said, the police and the state attorney's office are telling folks that when cases are still being actively investigated, the body cam footage is a piece of evidence and that they don't feel that it should be released until the investigations conclude. So as a public official, what's your response to that rationale?
I don't think that that's a valid rationale, but I want to be really, really clear. I think the challenge with the body cameras is we were so excited to have body cameras, but we didn't have policy attendant with it to ensure there was accountability. I would dare posit that you have no proof that a body camera has ever been turned on because it's up to the subjective judgment of the officers. Everyone presumes that there are videos. There may not be. Not if there's not a policy mandating or governing when I have to turn it on. If I say I am doing policing, right, and I am too busy or too involved with that, there is a presumption that I am going to turn it on before I have an encounter, but that's not a policy to require that presumption. So it's almost like a prophylactic measure, right? But it really has no teeth in it if we don't have
Will the city council, there would probably almost certainly not be majority support on the city council to compel the release of body cam footage in the city of Jacksonville. But what are your, and you have a strong sunshine law. You probably don't know what's in the minds of your fellow council members on this right now.
Well, I'll tell you
what's your role here?
And I'll tell you what Council President Designate Tommy Hazuri has already said. He said that as we have the budget process this year, and of course the City Council approves DSO's budget, there is going to be some substantive conversation regarding the budget and the body cameras or any other resources that the Council is approving for JSO. So I believe that there is going to be a rich community dialogue about, are you using them? Why have there not been videos released? If you're not using them, why not? What's the best way to ensure that the public has that degree of accountability? If nothing else, to say, these are the ongoing investigations. And I always tell everybody, you can cross-check whether or not it's being used as evidence just by going and following the case, the criminal defense case, right, and see if it's been produced there. I'm going to theorize that I don't know that there have been very many videos at all, very candidly.
Chris on the south side. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the radio.
Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm listening to, to the show. I'm enjoying. I'm enjoying the information. I'm enjoying having the city councilwoman on. I'm driving along, going to work, just thinking about stuff. I have two older daughters, and I have two younger sons. My sons are just not turning 20, and the other one is getting ready to turn 18. And I'm worried. You follow what I'm saying? And that is, and it's getting frustrating because it doesn't feel like anybody is hearing that. No one is hearing the fact that I, as a black man, am worried about, I'm worried about my daughters, but I have two young black men that are coming of age. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, dang, man, is anybody hearing us? What's going to happen? What are people doing? So I'm moved more now than ever. I'm 40 years old. I've never done anything concerning the city council, never been to the city council, never spoke up at the city council. But I tell you this, I'm more now than ever researching, looking up, trying to figure out when can I come to have my 3 minutes to say something or whatever, because I know we got to start stuff locally, then to the state, and then nationally. So I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Chris. Dr. Hodo, okay, a couple of things there. I'll get to Chris's comment in a moment, but first, we heard Brenda Priestley-Jackson talk about body cameras in Jacksonville and what the city council may do when it comes to reviewing the JSO budget and looking at oversight and accountability. You study this issue all over the country. How do we compare in the city of Jacksonville to the way other police departments are handling this issue?
Well, I have a hard time understanding why the tapes aren't being released, but I agree with the councilwoman. I wonder, are they actually utilizing them? I saw yesterday or the day before, I want to say in St. Louis, maybe there was an officer involved shooting and the body cameras were not on. And because of that, the police chief was relieved of duty. And that makes sense to me, because if we've invested this money, we have this strong sunshine state law, I'm not understanding why we're not able to see the documentation or the tape that they have, unless they have not been recording. And again, that's problematic in itself. We know that African-American males are profiled. We know that there are some issues in the community in regards to how black and brown bodies tend to be over-policed. When we look at mass incarceration, we see that. I think that the police, who I am definitely not anti-police, but they need to be held accountable. I have a very difficult time, and I am prior military, and I own my own consulting firm, All Things Diverse, and I have a really difficult time understanding why the good police, who are the vast majority, are not calling out the bad police who are, you know, racist or have these implicit bias ideologies about people of color. If they were to do that, then maybe people would stop protesting and we could actually have some honest dialogue. But I know, you know, the thin blue line is a major issue, and that's something that needs to be broken. You know, they need to be honest and tell on one another when they're doing something that is incorrect. The mere fact that the police officer thought that he could just sit there for 9 minutes on Mr. Floyd's neck with his hand in his pocket just shows you how unconcerned he was.
And the video is heartbreaking, and it's enraging. Now, I want to also follow up with you, Brenda Priestley Jackson. We heard from a listener saying he's going to become more politically engaged. What are your thoughts about what you're seeing locally? But, you know, also, as Tammy Oda pointed out, these issues within the police departments of America are real. They are real. At the same time, last night on social media, I saw examples of some police chiefs and police officers around the country actually marching in solidarity with protesters, kneeling with them, engaging with them. And so I think we also want to be careful not to paint everyone in law enforcement with the same brush. I just wanted to make that point as well. But what about the caller that said, you know what, I'm worried for my children and I'm going to engage more with local government? What are your thoughts about that, Councilwoman?
I think that is most appropriate, and I welcome it. And I want to call attention to the peaceful protest with Ben Frazier and the Northside Coalition that I actually started on Saturday. That was one of the most ethno-racially diverse groups of young people, a lot of millennials and Gen Z who want a better and a brighter day. And so that's my hope, and it's how we put our arms around them to make certain that we have opportunity for all in Jacksonville and that we don't target African Americans continuously. But for that father, my husband and I feel his pain. And I'm going to be very candid. It hasn't been limited to our sons. It's our sons and daughters. And so our children have gone to school around the country. As a mother and a father, we stay on the phone all night when they were driving in. Each of our children have been stopped by police. And I would be so bold as to say racially profiled at different times and have always called me. That's something I told them when they got their license in 2006. And that's the heartbreak and the angst and the pain of black parents all around this country, that when you can't find your daughter or son or you can't locate them, that something has happened at birth. And I don't know many black parents that don't have stories to share of their young people.
So when your kids were stopped, what happened to them?
They were told in the very beginning, whenever you are stopped by the police, when the police comes up to the car, call me immediately when you see the police lights in the window. But they would call us on the cell phone, and then they were told when the police came over, comply with the officer's request, keep their hands visible. Also share, I'm on the phone with my mom, who happens to be an attorney, and let them know you're recording everything. I'm very candid. People can't understand that these are the lessons that black parents have been telling their children for the last 30, 40 years. It's come to attention now since Trayvon Martin, since Michael Brown, since Ahmaud Arbery, but these were real-time conversations that black parents have with their kids for them to survive and live to see another day.
Stanley, second, Councilwoman, and I hope everyone's taking a moment to just process what you said. As a public official and an attorney and a mom.
Yeah.
All right. More people waiting to engage with you both. Stanley in Clay County. Go ahead, Stanley.
Hey, Melissa. I'm a longtime listener. Listen every day going to work.
Thanks.
At my church, we had a thing when Trayvon Martin happened. We had some police officers that goes to my church, and it's African-American, predominantly African-American, the Church 320. So we had a sit-down, and we talked about ideas around this and how to combat all of this and stay alive longer. And so what we came up with was, it's just an idea. I don't know if it's been pitched to anybody, but the chief police officer from Newark, New Jersey, who now retired here, he said that what if from the holster of the gun, if we have some kind of technology that if the gun is pulled, the body cam is activated. I think technology can help that. I think that would help. So I'd just like to hear what, if anyone's ever talked about that in city council, or if that mm-hmm. idea has ever been played
yeah.
out with.
I don't think it has been, that idea has been raised, but Dr. Tammy Hodo, again, I turn to your expertise, how this whole controversy is dealt with in other police jurisdictions as opposed to Jacksonville, and whether I have no idea if that caller's idea would technologically work or politically work, but what are your thoughts about what he said?
I think that that would be ideal. I think that as soon as the police officer pulls over someone or engages with someone, that the body camera should be required to put that body camera on. I, too, am the parent of an African-American male. We have a 17-year-old African-American son who recently graduated who drives. And, again, we have that conversation. And it's sad because it's not necessarily if you get pulled over, but when you get pulled over as an African-American male, this is what I need you to do. You know, and it's very difficult conversation to have with your children because we don't get to just talk about the birds and the bees, but we have to talk about your interactions with people in authority and the biases that they have via, you know, the major units of socialization that show, you know, African-American men not in a favorable light, you know, and we see people referring to them as thugs and drug dealers and all these derogatory things, and people internalize that and they begin to believe that, and it's problematic because then when you stop an African-American driver, those assumptions, those biases are at play, and our children and our men are not very safe, and I agree, and I mean our women as well. We saw Sandra Bland, what happened with her.
Yeah.
We just had Breonna Taylor, the EMT in Louisville,
yeah.
Kentucky,
yeah.
and what happened there, you know, and it's just, it has to stop, but we need to have some serious dialogue, and I think that policing, they really need to be trained on implicit bias, and as far as I know here,
yeah.
they are trained, but it seems to be only geared towards the LGBTQI community, and I don't know if they're actually addressing the racial.
And we will touch base to see what the latest procedures and training are with JSO. I know that de-escalation training has been part of what they do for some time, but this, you're right, this bears a further look-see. Here's an email from a listener. Sometimes dashboard cameras are activated when police pull someone over. Please mention that. Thanks for that. And let's go to Cameron on the west side. Go ahead, Cameron.
Hey, how's it going? I love the show. I was a part of the protest on Sunday in downtown Jacksonville. So I wake up the next day on Monday, and I'm seeing in the news, the local news media, a very different image than what was actually happening on the ground, as far as even something as simple as when we were at the main street bridge, it said the police were stopping us from crossing the bridge or entering onto the bridge, and that was never the intention. No one had any intention of going onto the bridge at all. We were doing like a circle around downtown and coming back to the courthouse. It was just in the pictures and the anglings and the way the words, things were worded, it was just completely different from what I actually saw at
mm-hmm.
every point of the protest, from the, you know, kind of like call saying that we were, you know, being violent or, you know, we were agitating the police. And, I pride myself in being a pretty truthful person, and that's just not the reality of what happened.
Were you detained or any friends? Or?
Thankfully, I wasn't. It really broke my heart. I can't, unfortunately, remember the first name, but Pastor Smith, that was detained. She was detained actually coming to calm me down at the end. And I didn't realize, I didn't even see that. I was told that the lady that prayed over us in the beginning had been detained. And then I looked it up and saw that it was her. And that, I mean, that broke my heart, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people that I saw that were detained, from what I saw, and don't get me wrong, I only have one set of eyes. The vast majority of them were people who were just walking, just standing there, cameramen, camerawomen, not people that were throwing things or breaking things. I didn't personally witness. I think the only thing I witnessed that was even remotely violent from the protesters was somebody, I didn't actually see who, threw a water bottle. It landed on the ground, didn't hit anybody. And that was probably when people just started getting pepper sprayed or mace at that point. Not the person who threw it, everybody else. So
okay,
I just yeah. This is what I saw and what I saw.
Thank you, yeah, thank you, Cameron, for letting us sharing what you saw and experienced. And you know, there has been some property damage downtown. The supervisor of elections office, its glass got damaged. The glass at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center are the two that come to mind. Now, Brenda Priestley Jackson, you know, we're still waiting to hear, by the way, if the people that were arrested have been released, following up on that this morning. But getting back to what we were talking about earlier, lots of tweets coming into the show and emails, and they tend to fall on one or two lines. Either people are emailing us saying they're angry about the property damage, or they're connecting with us and saying, I'm angry about racism and police violence, and I think something needs to be done about it. Those are the two buckets people fall into. Here's a tweet from a listener. The best chance for reform within the police department would come from kneecapping their budget. That would bring structural change. That's not politically likely in this city, is it?
No, I don't think so. And let me be clear. I think you have to require more accountability, right? And so every year we have, we have more funding of our police budget. It grows and grows and grows, but our crime is not going down. And so I think that this year there are going to be some real conversations. Is that the best use for our budgetary dollars in terms of just inflating it on that end? Are there some of the intervention and prevention measures, education and jobs, that we might want to look into? I will tell you, you will not probably find a council member who's going to be comfortable cutting the police budget, right, the GSO budget. I don't know policing the way the sheriff's office does, but I can ask the question. I can make certain that I am a good steward of our taxpayers' dollars and we have appropriate accountability. I can ask, if you have body cameras and we expended X, what's the policy attendant with it? How can we shore that up to give the public the accountability? Because it's to foster trust between the community and JSO. And Melissa, one thing I really want to say, one of the biggest challenge for me through all of this, I think we have a very narrow view of the history of policing in America. I mean, the history of policing in America has always, one way or another, been to control certain populations, and a lot of times that's been the African-American population. I don't know that that has unfortunately radically changed, and that's where the change comes, and I'm sure Dr. Hodel may have additional insights into that in terms of the police academy, the courses that are taught. You know, what are we teaching? You know, I was always taught this black, white, and blue. Black, white, and blue. And blue covered every ethno-racial group. And one of the interesting things about the disarming video of George Floyd being murdered is that was a little diverse group of police officers around him, wasn't it? Who didn't intervene or stop. They were blue. They weren't black, white, Asian, Latino, or Hispanic. They were blue. And so I think these are the things that we have to look into as a community to make certain that we are addressing that. Police force reflects the values of a society. If we want them to change and value our lives, we have to change the instruction and our process for teaching them.
Lots of comments on Facebook. Allison writes, if it's not okay to take a knee before a game, and it's not okay to peacefully protest if you're in the path of the president on the way to a photo op, how can the marginalized express themselves and seek justice? Okay, and that's just one example of lots of viewpoints on our Facebook page. Tammy Hoder, we're coming up against a break, but I'd like to close with your final thoughts about what's happening in this country right now.
I think that people need to be educated. And again, the relationship with the communities, marginalized communities, and the police have a long history. We can look at slave patrols. We know that not until slavery was outlawed, you know, emancipation did vagrancy begin to, that was initiated and was against the law. I want people to understand that when people say Black Lives Matter and we hear All Lives Matter, that's not helpful. We understand that all lives matter, but at this point with the Black Lives Matter movement, what they want to call out is the continued injustices that we were just speaking about, you know, and focus on the ones that are continuously being subjugated and disregarded, you know, and it's one of the things that we have to address in society, and we need to fix the relationship between marginalized community and the police.
And
we need to have police officers understand how to interact with communities and people of different ethnicities than their own.
And we will continue to have these conversations on this program. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us, Councilmember Brenda Priestley-Jackson and Dr. Tammy Hodo, UNF. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us, Pete.
Much more still ahead on the show. Later, we'll go outside for a little taste of wild Florida as summer begins. But up next,
they've been driven into this very paranoid state that they're, you know, concerned and scared about the virus and contracting it.
COVID fatigue. It's literally driving some psych patients to distraction. That's next. Well, coronavirus fatigue is getting to all of us right now. Millions of Americans are depressed, anxious, or just plain stressed out as the pandemic drags on. Most people are coping the best they can, but some are truly struggling with major anxiety. You need to reach out for help if that's you. I spoke about it with Dr. Marek Hirsch, psychiatry specialist at Memorial Hospital. Dr. Marek Hirsch, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Nice to be with you.
Well, the stay-at-home orders have been difficult for everyone, but there are some who literally have been driven almost to the brink of insanity by the pandemic and what we've all been dealing with. People are anxious, people are depressed, people are developing paranoia, fears. We're all under so much stress. What are you seeing with your patients, and how are you trying to help them right now?
Sure. So I'm an inpatient psychiatrist at Memorial Hospital, so if you're seeing me, you're definitely at a point where you need some help, you know, where outpatient services aren't enough for you. So we're seeing really a spectrum of patients. For the first time, people who have not been admitted to the hospital before, some, as you said, are being admitted because they've been driven into this very paranoid state that they're, you know, concerned and scared about the virus and contracting it, and they're socially distancing themselves and having to take that so seriously. But it's just not a part of, you know, normal human behavior to have to put on rubber gloves and wear a mask and do things in situations that really are just completely unnecessary. You see people at an intersection and they have a mask on in their own car. They're by themselves with the windows up. And it's just taking things to an extreme that is driving people crazy. And when mm-hmm. we're seeing people admitted because of that. But then, of course, the economic impacts have been really dramatic. So you have people who haven't had a paycheck in months. They don't know where they're going to how they're going to pay their mortgage. They don't know how they're going to pay their bills. They're enclosed in you know, in a home with someone that they probably otherwise love, but you know, cabin fever sets in,
yeah.
And all of a sudden there's these interpersonal conflicts, and you know, the liquor stores were considered essential businesses, so they never closed. So people have had a lot to drink as well, and in this situation, it doesn't help things. So we're seeing people coming in for those reasons as well.
And then compounded on all of that, we've seen a week of unrest across the country, too.
Certainly. I mean, the situation I'm assuming you're referring to, these riots, and,
yeah.
You know, in response to the George Floyd killing, that is certainly an added stress. It's maybe unrelated to coronavirus. I don't know if the pent-up anxiety from months of quarantining had anything to do with sort of, you know, setting off that reaction in such an extreme. Certainly,
it certainly you know. Didn't help, though, right? I mean, yeah.
Right.
Well, let me ask you then, Doctor, how are you helping patients right now, and what advice do you have for people out there who are struggling?
Well, we're taking it a day at a time with people who are here on the inpatient unit, and certainly providing you know, our regular services where necessary. If people do need some help from a medicine, if they need to be detoxed off of a drug or off of alcohol, we're certainly, you know, doing that for them, trying to help them, you know, mend their relationships at home. Unfortunately, as I tell patients, you know, whether we're on quarantine or not, I don't have a magic pill that can pay your bills and replenish your bank account. So there are those practical problems that people are still facing that, unfortunately, I can't help with. But we do have social workers on our unit, of course, that can help connect people with social services if they qualify. And we certainly do have, you know, quite a bit available for people who need it. And then, of course, those who are being driven, as we said, into this state of paranoia where they're just more severely sick, you know, and mentally ill. We have other services for them. We do offer electroconvulsive therapy. We've had patients come in completely catatonic, actually, because they've been so worried about it. And so we've had to provide some different forms of treatment than just medication to help those people as well.
People that aren't physically sick, but they're just, they're so worried about getting sick. Is that it?
Right. And so when your mind is so preoccupied and just kind of going into this this tornado of anxiety, and you just drive yourself into a depressed, anxious state, you can become psychotic. It affects your sleeping pattern. It affects your eating patterns, you know, which can then affect you medically as well. So people become very depressed. And then on the extreme end of things, like I just said, catatonia is a state where people are actually unresponsive and unable to take care of themselves at all. So we actually usually see them on the medical floor, we do have some medicines that can help them. We have to sort of provide supportive medical care in the form of nutrition and hydration, but often we do have to then provide them with electroconvulsive therapy to sort of snap them out of this catatonic state.
Wow. So some extreme situations for some patients out there. I guess the message then is people shouldn't wait until they're in full-blown crisis mode to reach out for medical help.
Absolutely. As I mentioned at the beginning, I'm an inpatient psychiatrist, so I'm talking about extreme cases. I certainly think the vast majority of people aren't going to end up maybe on an inpatient unit, but certainly so many people out there are worried and struggling and concerned. And so we do have a hotline here at Memorial just for people with coronavirus-related concerns. They can access that number on the Memorial website, and we have mental health professionals that are available for them to speak with.
So don't be afraid to make the call. And I want to thank you so much. He's Dr. Marek Hirsch with Memorial Hospital in Jacksonville. Thank you so much, doctor.
All right. No problem, Melissa. You take care.
In a moment, Wild Florida. We'll be right back.
Since the coronavirus pandemic began, we have heard from so many of you that in an uncertain world, listening to NPR and this station is familiar, that public radio is a constant, even a comfort. The feeling is mutual. We are so grateful that you are here with us. You make the public radio community even stronger when you become a sustaining member of this station. Here's how.
Go to wjct.org/radio and thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, science writer Sonia Shah. Her 2016 book, Pandemic, warned of deadly viral outbreaks. Her new book, The Next Great Migration, is about why migration is an enduring feature of human history and how it affects the people on the move and the countries they move to. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
A lot of workers who lost their jobs in March were thinking they would be back working right about now. And while that is true for some workers, for others...
Now it feels less certain that jobs are going to be there waiting for us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Employment, unemployment, and just general life. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Dozens of curfews have now been imposed in cities across the country. Most protests have started off peacefully. But why do some become violent? I'm Sasha Ann Simons. That conversation and the latest on the growing unrest, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, summer is almost here, and even though it's starting to heat up out there, it's still a great time to enjoy our region's natural beauty. Right now, you can spot sea turtles nesting, dolphins frolicking, and more. Our regular contributor, Lisa Garuba, is a Florida master naturalist and journalist. She's on the line with a little bit of wild Florida today. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Good to have you. So a lot of changes over the last couple months as spring gives way to summer. What's going on outside?
Well, we are at the beginning of sea turtle nesting season, and they have just started to come ashore. We've got maybe less than 10, I think, out of Nassau, Duval, St. John's, and Flagler. But by the end of the season in September, we should have seen about 3,000 nests. That's what we had last year. Those are mostly loggerhead turtle nests. About 2,500 of them are loggerhead nests, mm-hmm. and the rest are green turtle nests. And so they are starting to come ashore on our beaches, and basically they come up in the evening, and they kind of go, you know, back to the dune area and lay a nest. And so we have sea turtle patrols on every single beach, and they're out making sure that the beaches stay. Their hashtag is clean, dark, and flat. So there's no obstructions to the turtles. There's no big holes or anything that people maybe dug, you know, at the beach during the day. They'll try to get those filled in and basically just kind of watch the nest and make sure it stays protected until the babies start to hatch in July.
Yeah, and it's always so exciting to watch the babies run to the sea. I want to make a right. quick mention of a wonderful man who just passed away a week or so ago, Bobby Taylor. Great guy. And I'll never forget the night he called us up to, I think it was Huguenot Park, so we could take our kids and watch the baby sea turtles make their run to the ocean. I have some amazing pictures of that night with my kids. Okay, so sea turtles happening, and there are a lot of pictures on social media of dolphins in the river right now.
Right. And so I think it's because we do have more dolphins this time of year in the river, and we have more people out boating. I talked to a marina owner who said that they are really slammed because of this, you know, the stay-at-home orders. They are selling gasoline and doing boat repairs like crazy. And I know that we're seeing a lot of people paddleboarding, kayaking, jet skiing, what have you. So we do have more people out there. At the same time, we have more dolphins and manatees at this during the summer months. Out in the river. The dolphins, we have a population of about 300 that live in the river. And during the winter, 200 or so will go down the intercoastal and spend the winter down in Titusville. And then again, turn around and come back in the summer. It's a group that tends to be between the downtown bridges, say out to the intercoastal. It's a distinct group from the dolphins that are offshore. They're a different group. They don't go back and forth. And so I talked to Dr. Rose Borkowski, who's a researcher in the Biology and Marine Science Department at Jacksonville University. And she said she recommended some places to view them if you don't have a boat. You can see them from the downtown bridges. They seem to be feeding around the bridges. You can see them from Friendship Park, Blue Cypress Park, Ready Point Park, and the Fort Caroline Dock.
Okay.
There's no particular time of day. They're just...
But keep your eyes out. Yeah, keep your eyes out for them.
Absolutely.
Most parks are open.
Absolutely.
Most parks are open now. People are still getting outside, though, and hiking. June 6th is National Trails Day, you say, right?
Right, absolutely. And Now, for some people, it's gotten a little too hot and they're done for the year until it cools off, but there are people still out hiking. I put a question on the Florida Hiking Alliance Facebook page asking for local recommendations for people where they can get out here in Northeast Florida, and especially with kids. I feel like there's probably a lot of people who've got pent-up kids at home and are trying to, you know, get them outside. And the recommendations I got, I'll rattle them off really quickly. The Spanish Pond Trail in the Theodore Roosevelt area is good because it's shaded. Jack's Arboretum and UNS is easy for kids, easy hiking for kids. Also, Tree Hill in Arlington.
Okay.
And at the Arboretum, it's popular with kids who play Pokemon Go. also, Bogey Creek, which is a North Florida Land Trust, I believe a recently acquired property from North Florida Land Trust. Hannah Park trails are good because then at the end of the trail, you can go in the ocean and cool off.
Sure. And I hate to cut you off. We're almost out of time. And I know you wanted to quickly mention how people can bring a little wild Florida into their yard do some planting.
Yes, I watched an amazing webinar in May, and it was sponsored by the Florida Wildlife Foundation. They had a talk from a biologist named Doug Tallamy, who talked about using native plants to attract birds and other species. It was a really, really good webinar. And so I recommend it's on YouTube, or go on the Florida Wildlife Foundation's page and Facebook page, and you can find the link to his talk.
And check that out. Now, to close out our Wild Florida, you asked us to play a classic by John Prine, Paradise. This is something you felt kind of evoked the back roads and wild places of this country. Is that right, Lisa?
Well, yeah, that's what he wrote about, was taking the back roads to the family home and kind of that longing for home and for the outdoors. And I thought it was a good time to play a John Prine song. He died in April of COVID.
He did. It was very sad that we lost him. So take a listen. And I want to thank you, Lisa Vick Gruba. It's our Wild Florida. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.